My name's Todd. I'm glad to be here. And my focus is really going to be about this story of resistance as I entered into this work, I really had this imperialist idea that the Acadians and the Mi'kmaq and the Maliseet were really pawns of the French in their efforts, war efforts against the British Empire establishing themselves here. That was at best. They were pawns of the French. At worst, they were just passive, helpless victims that were being, swished around by the empires. And the more I did research around this, I really found this story through reading some of the scholarly work and the post-colonial histories that have been written as of late, this story of resistance that the Acadians, Mi'kmaq, and Maliseet, and the Wabanaki Confederacy, by extension, which I'll explain more, was the Aboriginal umbrella group for this region, and the kind of efforts they put into actually defending their land, standing up for their values, and protecting their families. And so this story of resistance against the British Empire is really the focus of my conversation tonight, and that it was resistance, it was armed resistance. So what I'm going to be focused on is a 75-year period that started in 1688 and ended with the burial of the hatchet ceremony after approximately 75 years of and six wars later. A burial of a hatchet ceremony that happened at on Spring Garden Road in front of the courthouse, and I'll talk about the implications of that. During that time period, again, there was six wars that happened, so I'm going to actually be going through these six wars. So the Wabanaki Confederacy includes, not that everybody agrees that it includes the Mi'kmaq, but for the sake of this presentation, I'm going to say that the Mi'kmaq were part of the Wabanaki Confederacy. And the Maliseet, who were the around St. John. And Acadia extends down to midway through Maine, around Castine, Maine. And that becomes an important part of the story, the border between Acadia and New England. So the just to give you an overview of the story, so in the First War, King William's War, as it was known in North America, there's a lot of fighting down on the border, between Acadia and New England. In the Second War, basically, mainland Nova Scotia is lost to the French. Now, I want to be clear, I really like John Reed's notion that this is really a kind of polite fiction, that the idea that, one, the French own it, and then, two, that the British are now owning it, that really the Aboriginal community still controls the area militarily. So, I mean, while there's this kind of chess game going on between the French and the English about who owns this land, it's more, it makes sense to me, it's more of a polite fiction. But I am going to share the polite fiction just to carry this narrative forward. So that the English claim mainland Nova Scotia after the Second War, and the Third War during this time period, Maine goes from being controlled by the, or being claimed by the French, to being claimed by the English. The Fourth War, the boundaries remain the same. In the Fifth War, what we now know as New Brunswick ends up falling. And then in the Sixth War, the French and Indian War, both Cape Breton and PEI fall. But again, at the same time, the Mi'kmaq are here the whole time, and the Maliseet are still operating, but this is the polite fiction that's going on between the English and the French. I'll come back to that. So with the First War, in terms of maintaining the border of Acadia, the 9 Years' War, and so part of what's happening here is that the French missionaries are put into place throughout Acadia as a means of, I think it's also accurate to call them military agents, too, not just priests, but they were also involved in converting the Aboriginal population and mobilizing them too towards, so they become Catholic. So there's a really an argument to be made that there's really a Catholic alliance between the Aboriginal communities, the Acadian community, and the French against the British, who are Protestant, of course. So part of how that's managed is through the priests. Castine, he is stays in. He has a trading post down here at what's actually called Castine, Maine now. And the capital, so this becomes a big part of Acadia, an important part of Acadia, gets severed off in our kind of local histories because we focus so much on the maritime history, but an important part of Acadia is actually playing out on the other side of the international border in Maine. So Castine, Maine's down there. At one point, Castine is made the capital of Acadia because they're trying to defend this border. So it really is quite important and often gets lopped off of Acadia, the history of Acadia. So St. Castine is a trader, and he shows up he stays for 31 years among the Aboriginal people. So he's a player in this case. But this story around attacks coming from Acadia actually includes the Aboriginal population too. So just to be clear about that. So the first attack here is on Castine. In response to that, these are the attacks that come back. Now historically, the conversation really has highlighted that the attacks are coming from Quebec. But part of what the research, that I've been looking at, and some of John Reed's work, of course, and others, have highlighted that it wasn't only coming down from Quebec City, that it was actually coming also from Acadia over to New England. So these were counter raids. Raids could be anything from, so in the case of Portland, Maine, what's now known as Portland, Maine, there was like 100 people were killed and 100 people taken prisoner. So, basically all of Portland was wiped out. So, again, went from that to raids where, a family might have been killed here and there. And part of the idea in terms of that skulking way of war was that when a family was killed on the frontier, it was about creating terror in the whole community. And then you'd get basically communities that would retreat back to wherever the closest fort was. So that was part of the campaign, was to go in and to strike and then retreat, but you were still setting terror in. And also there's stories of, in terms of some of these attacks of prisoners being taken to the side of the settlements and tortured during the night so the whole community could hear. And so that's part of the warfare. And again, it's not to look back at it with some sense of judgment from our contemporary lens, just to give you a sense of how the warfare was conducted. So also, then there was an attack on Port Royal in retaliation. Then the New Englanders put a fort at what's now Bristol, Maine. And then that was attacked by numerous Mi'kmaq and other people from the Wabanaki Confederacy. Again, these efforts are supported by the French. I'm not trying to take the imperial interest out of this. I'm just trying to highlight that there is also agency and choice within the local population of Acadians and Aboriginal. In retaliation for taking out the New England fort at Castine, this is Benjamin Church, he then goes off to Acadia and torches what's now close to Amherst, that was then called Beaubassin. And what he does is when he gets there, the Acadians say, we don't have anything to do with this. And then he finds a note on the church door celebrating this, the fact that they had just taken out this New England fortress, and so he torched the place. So, and of course, when the church is coming, they're also firing at him, not wanting him to come ashore. He also goes up to, when Port Royal was attacked, the capital of Acadia moved up to what's now Fredericton. And part of that interest was that there was a Maliseet village, Metaduck, up on close to Fredericton. So part of the idea was to coordinate with the Maliseet these attacks on the New England border. And there was also attack over at Canso. So in the Second War, losing mainland Nova Scotia, in terms of the polite fiction, the War of Spanish Succession, and this is the grave of Father Riel, and Father Riel is on the front line here on the border between New England and Acadia, and he lives there for 27 years among the native population. And there's also in terms of the at Beaubassin, close to Amherst there, Father Trouvé was actually the French priest who was there. And there's actually some documentation about Acadians writing that the priest isn't militant enough in his efforts. So this starts off with raids into New England. And one of these raids in particular, 1703, there's a raid that involves 200 Mi'kmaq from and Beaubassin, the Beaubassin son, so Beaubassin, and then the son of Beaubassin comes down. And there's 200 Mi'kmaq, 300 people are killed in this campaign on the border. And part of what I was interested about this attack was just that they had arranged that six villages were attacked all at the same time on the New England border. So that part of what that just kind of illuminated for me was just that these weren't just like random acts that happened periodically from time to time, that there was actually a campaign happening here. Again, in response to that, Benjamin Church, and he's considered the father of American ranging, and so he actually has some kind of stature within the American military circles. So he, in 1704, comes up and first takes out Castine, and then comes and attacks Grand Pré. And it's to read the primary sources around his raid of Grand Pré, it's fascinating, because he gets he accosts and gets an Acadian guide to take him up to Grand Pré. And unbeknownst to Church, the guide jumps ship, and Church, he sends a letter Acadians saying, you know, surrender. But what he doesn't know is that the tide is going out. So his boat actually gets stuck on the mud flats. The Acadians can see him out there in his boat, and so they just shuffle off as much as they can before he can get on shore. And so he sinks down into the mud, and this is all in his written documentation. And then the boat rises. He's coming out of one of those crevices or whatever, and he thinks that he's going to be still far enough below, because he's in this kind of crevice, he thinks he's going to be far enough below to be able to, you know, hide behind the mud. What he doesn't realize is that the water keeps rising and rising and rising and rising, and he's opened for fire by the Acadian and the Mi'kmaq. So then he comes ashore and also burns the village. He then goes on to what's now Falmouth, and also burns Falmouth, and takes prisoner there Noel Durand. For some people are familiar with the history of Noel Nova Scotia. He takes Noel Durand. Then he also goes back to Beaubassin, which he threatened to do the first time if this warfare wasn't going to stop, that he was going to come back, and in fact he does. And he claims in his writings that he only left five buildings left standing in Acadia. The New Englanders also go after the priest. They put a bounty out on Réal's life, and they also go down to Port Royal, and with the fall of Port Royal, the conquest of Acadia, mainland Acadia falls to the British. So the third war, Father Réal's War, happens between 1722 and 1725. Now there's also a mission at Shubenacadie that becomes important as this story plays out. Dummer, so this governor of Massachusetts, and sometimes it's called Dummer's War, but I'm highlighting, I like the reference to Father Réal's War in terms of highlighting the importance of the French priests for orchestrating the warfare. And so the New Englanders attack Réal first, and they aren't successful in terms of actually capturing him. They also take out another mission. And in response to that, you get this campaign that begins against New England along the border of New England and Maine. And this kind of campaign happens seasonally, so it happens in the spring, summer. You know, they don't do it in the winter. And so this same kind of campaign happens 1722, 1723, there's 14 raids, 1724 campaign, there's 10 raids. So these basically were clearing out the Protestants, preventing any migration into Acadia. Oh, also at this point, there's a gathering of Mi'kmaq that are gathering at Grand Pré. And what that sets off was that the governor of Nova Scotia at this point, mainland Nova Scotia, takes hostage 22 Mi'kmaq. And the idea is he's taking them hostage so they don't get attacked, because if they get attacked by this group of Mi'kmaq that's forming, then there'll be trouble. So part of it is he takes these hostages to try and protect themselves. The Mi'kmaq then begin to create a blockade of Nova Scotia to try and starve the capital. So they go and they start attacking the fishermen that are around the coast. They capture up to 82 prisoners. And in response, down at what's now Jador Harbor, the New Englanders are trying to stop this, of course. On one occasion, the New Englanders and the Mi'kmaq are having, you know, somewhat of a naval battle in Jador Harbor, and the New Englanders put to fire the Mi'kmaq boat. 39 Mi'kmaq start to swim ashore. The New Englanders kill 35 of them in the water as they're retreating, and they take five of the bodies that they are able to get a hold of, and they take the scalps of the Mi'kmaq and put them on post around Canso to warn off anybody. So to be clear, that the only two posts here that are actually English, even though England is claiming Nova Scotia, mainland Nova Scotia, is their own, they're really only at Port Royal, Annapolis Royal, and Canso, and they really can't come out of their forts or they'll be killed. You know, so the range of their influence in the province is very small, even though they claim that this is the conquest and we finally have this land. The reality on the ground wasn't that simple. And you hear governors who arrive here, including Cornwallis, quite disappointed that the fiction isn't true. You know, is that, oh, I thought we kind of ruled this place. And they come here and they find out that in fact, wasn't the case. Then Father Riel is actually killed along with seven other chiefs. And that, in terms of the polite fiction, takes out what now is considered Maine. Mazarin is governor of Nova Scotia. Father Le Loutre is at Shubenacadie during this war. So the priests aren't just like orchestrating from behind, they're actually orchestrating from the front. They're actually in these battles, you know, they're not just orchestrating them, they're actually participants. And so Father Le Loutre, they twice try and attack the capital, Annapolis Royal, and are unsuccessful, and also once at Canso. Then Louisbourg, of course, the famous 1745 siege, that also takes out PEI. And then also at Port Toulouse, there's also a battle that happens there just prior to actually the siege of Louisbourg. In response, 3 weeks after the siege of Louisbourg, which frankly I haven't read anybody actually make this connection, there's a huge campaign down at the other than Governor Shirley. I haven't seen anybody make the connection between this attack that happens on Louisbourg and then the response to it 3 weeks later on the border. Again, if this part of our history is outside of the study of Acadia, you know, we can see kind of what we're missing. Also, there's a great story that people probably well know here in terms of the Duke Danville, the biggest fleet to come over prior to the American Revolution. And this is France getting serious about trying to take mainland Nova Scotia back. And of course, the disease overcomes the ship, and the whole expedition is a disaster, to say the least. Ramsay, a guy coming down from Quebec, actually comes down with troops and gathers Aboriginal people along his way and warriors. And he actually comes down in the middle of winter by snowshoes, so they're marching down here from Quebec City. And they're waiting to meet up with this Duke Danville fleet, which they don't know is not going to make it, but they're waiting for it to, because they're going to be the land force, while the Duke Danville is going to be the water force, to be able to take the capital and also to take Louisbourg back. And while he's stationed at Beaubassin, at present-day Amherst, he actually sends troops over, the Mi'kmaq go with him, to Prince Edward Island, and close to where Port La Jolie, close to Charlottetown, is, there's actually, they find that there's New Englanders there because they have just taken over the place. And he goes over, and it's the 29th Regiment, and it's an interesting part of their regimental history that they're called ever-sworded, the 29th Regiment, because basically of the 49 men that were on shore, 45 were massacred. And part of what happened was that they had left their arms back at a tent, and they were out you know, getting hay or whatever in the field, and then they were slaughtered. And so that regimental history now is that they always are armed. So ever sworded was part of that, and that remains to this day. And piecing together that regimental history and tying it back to PEI was fascinating. But also, so there was that, and then he also went, British were trying to move up the Bay of Fundy. They get as far as Grand Pre, and then again Ramsay in the snowshoes comes through the middle of winter, late night in February, and attack the New England soldiers. And there's a battle that ensues. It's probably the bloodiest one that happens, actually. We're within such close quarters to the Acadians, where 53 French are killed, 67 English are killed, 40 English prisoners, and 40 wounded. Part of this Father Luther's War then happens next. This is connected to the founding of Halifax. This is Cornwallis, of course. And in this Fifth War, so I'm drawing on William Wickham's work by identifying that Halifax is illegally founded. So there was a treaty of 1726 after Father Rial's War, in which the British agreed that they would negotiate whatever kind of further settlements in Nova Scotia would happen. And so Cornwallis came and unilaterally set up Halifax. And so this was really an act of aggression in terms of the local Mi'kmaq community. And so in response to that, the Mi'kmaq start to attack the British. So this is Halifax here. So, and not only is Halifax being set up, but the New Englanders and English are British are really making an effort now to control the whole area. So they actually set up a fort in all the major Acadian villages, one at Grand Pre, one at what's now Windsor or Fort Edward. And of course, Fort Edward really is a national treasure. It's the oldest blockhouse in North America. And it was built on, just in terms of the, you know, what the Acadians must have thought of the British, the, you know, Acadians were forced to tear down their church on the spot and erect this, you know, fort. So I'm guessing they weren't, you know, too pleased about that. There's also a fort, Lawrence Fort, up at Fort Lawrence, up at Amherst. Also, Lunenburg was settled shortly after, so 1749, Halifax was settled shortly after Lunenburg was settled, and then Lawrencetown was settled as well. Again, Father Le Loutre is significantly orchestrating the warfare. The French put up opposite Fort Lawrence, Fort Beauséjour. There's another fort on the other side, and a fort at satellite forts at one at St. John. So it was interesting for me to think of the founding of Halifax as, in some respect, an act of war, the founding of Lunenburg as an act of war, the founding of Lawrencetown as an act of war. So then the Mi'kmaq begin to attack at Canso. There's numerous attacks at Chignecto. And then they move into Halifax. There's an attack at Grand Pre, the siege of Grand Pre. And there's also a battle with Gorham and his rangers and the Mi'kmaq on his way to build the fort at Windsor. The attacks that are happening on Dartmouth, just two that I'll bring your attention to. One was our Cornwallis' gardener and his son, and four others were out, obviously outside the perimeters, and were killed by Mi'kmaq. And also the attack on Dartmouth that happened in 51, where there's varying accounts in terms of the numbers, but on the high range was that 20 settlers were killed, and really that imperiled the kind of development for Dartmouth for quite a while. After all these raids, it took it a while to, you know, to get on its feet, to say the least. I also want to just plug, because this is the Maritime Museum of the Atlantic, that there was John Roos, was the kind of the Marine head. Captain in terms of the naval operation. So, and Sylvanus Cobb is just under him, and they would be basically maneuvering all these soldiers all over the place, and also monitoring the shoreline in terms of munitions coming in to be given to the priest to be handed on and so forth. So just in response to that raid on Dartmouth, this fence was built, and there's a fence, and this fence goes quite far down where Dartmouth is. So just to give you some sense of the fact that this really was effective resistance. They really were scared. They really did build these forts to protect themselves. Towards the end of the war, there's the battle of at Fort Beauséjour, which is taken out. That takes out the two satellite forts. And again, the fiction is that New Brunswick is now lost to the British. So, and then in the final war, the French in Indian War, or the Seven Years' War, this is Lawrence. And of course, people are familiar with the deportation of the Acadians and the campaigns that went on there. So they first were removed from Chignecto, went down through Grand Pre, Port Royal. So the two last remaining French occupations, even after 1755, were both present-day Cape Breton and present-day PEI. So after the siege of 1758 Louisbourg, that took out Cape Breton, which also then took out PEI. And then there was a campaign. So these are all campaigns against the Acadians, which really, and probably many people here have, it's pretty fascinating reading some of the accounts of the kind of British officers who were engaged in that campaign. Because, well, you know, I've been talking about resistance and so forth, there was certainly a civilian population that was completely devastated, and it was clear to the officers like Wolfe and so forth that, you know, that this really was an overreaction to these people in terms of the, in terms of some of the removal and burning of all their communities. So there's also Petitcodiac campaign and also a St. John River campaign that happens. I think this is the common story that's known from this period. This is a French officer, popular guy, who actually was instrumental in part of the resistance to this, and that this is part of the raids that went on during the... they didn't take it lightly. So there were lots of raids and attacks in relationship to this this time period. So in 1755, this was part of the response down into Maine. And also, I mean, part of you can see in terms of just the ability of the Aboriginal community to keep this resistance up. So part of what I wanted to highlight just in the closing here is the what actually happens on the Lunenburg Peninsula. There's an attack on what was called Pezant Island, now called Covey Island, and it's on Marie Pezant. And so part of what happens is the story is that the Maliseet and Mi'kmaq come down from actually close to Fredericton, and they attack this family, and they kill the father, they kill a servant and her infant child, and then they march the mother, who's pregnant, along with her three youngest children back to Quebec City. So that's part of, sets this in motion in terms of the raids. Then they, in response to this first raid, the British begin to build blockhouses around the peninsula. So one's over in Dayspring, one northwest, one up a blockhouse. But in response to that, the raids keep coming. You know, so there's actually 9 raids on Lunenburg Peninsula during this time period. So in terms of this period of warfare, ends primarily with the burying of the hatchet ceremony, June 25th, 1761, happens on Spring Garden Road, reportedly in front of the courthouse. It's a friendship and reciprocity treaty. And the British, really, some of the reports, like from Reverend Wood at the time, talking about Malliard, who his plaque is here. It's actually on the Catholic Church on the corner there. Reverend Wood, when Malliard died, actually said, thanks to Malliard, many Englishmen were saved from being massacred. So they were, like, they didn't take the treaty lightly. They were, like, relieved to have the warfare end. But in terms of what this actually meant, and of course John Reed's work has been extremely helpful in understanding the context in which these treaties were played out, is that my sense of John Reed's work is that, and I'm sure he'll correct me, my sense of John Reed's work is that that it was really, it was not a conquest, it was an accommodation. So for stopping the warfare against the British, the Mi'kmaq agreed to stop with the idea that the English would give them presents. And that was a long tradition with the French as well. And so part of what I think that we could interpret that presence, today we might call it rent. And that, in fact, throughout the that sense of the presence kind of got lost through the 19th century, and it began to be called relief for the natives, for the Aboriginals. And maybe today we might call it welfare. But in fact, the origins of it was rent, that we were actually paying rent. So it was an accommodation. It was not a conquest. You know, I find that quite shocking, you know. So the warfare ends there. There's some rumblings throughout the American Revolution in terms of joining the Americans in that warfare. And there's still some tension throughout the continued period that the natives will again, pick up the military, as a strategy, which doesn't actually happen. But so it takes quite a while. But these treaties actually hold up in the long term. And it's really throughout the 19th century that the British begin to turn it again into relief and start moving and migrating over all the land and so forth of the Mi'kmaq community. This is a pretty new story for me around this kind of resistance that happened within this region. You know, the fact that there was like six wars that happened, and I never heard about any of this stuff. You know, may have heard about a raid and a battle here and natives coming out of the woods, but really I didn't know that much before, I researched this. And I think part of the reason why is because of the kind of imperial colonial history that I was probably more familiar with, that again just saw Acadians and Aboriginal people as pawns of the empires. So not thinking of them actually as people who had, their own reasons to fight, that may have been connected to protecting their families, maritimers who wanted to protect their way of life and their own values and so forth. So actually thinking of them as agents of their own, with their own objectives, it seems like a more of a post-colonial history sensibility. Also in terms of Acadian history, I think that within that Acadian history, I think often when we tell the history of Acadia, I think I was only thinking of the French-speaking population and really excluded the significance of the Aboriginal population. But now, just as I've kind of moved through this research for myself, I've really found that I don't think in my original research was around Noel Durand, an Acadian, prominent Acadian. And now I really think that I can't really understand the Acadian experience unless I understand more of the context that they were living under. So it's not, I can't, and I think often those kind of nationalistic histories of the Acadian people often don't do justice to the kind of relationship that was going on there in terms of the Aboriginal context that the Acadians were living in. Also in terms of just the international border, again, focusing on the Maritimes as primarily the site of Acadia, where, part of what I can see is that really lops off a very important piece of Acadia in terms of that what was actually going on in Maine and on that border with New England. And also in terms of the Mackay's work, I really like around this stuff in terms of his analysis of tourism efforts in the 20th century, really were about kind of sanitizing, I think, our history and kind of like the idea that we'd all just be happy. We had like the order of good cheer, it was making us all, we're a happy place to come. And I think that part of what that, I think that's probably a misguided strategy in terms of actually circulating history that way. I think that we'd be much better served by actually acknowledging the conflict that was happening and really acknowledging and commemorating the military figures that really served on both sides who were protecting maritime families. I think also people have been nervous about this story of resistance because I think that that it brings up nervousness that somehow it's going to excuse the expulsion. It's just going to justify and excuse what happened, or that it's going to justify and excuse crossing the the treaty violations that happened. And it seems to me that we can be just present to both, that they're, just in terms of the British actions and what they did, and that we could still, recognize this kind of resistance that went on, and the fact that it could be a source of pride for maritimers, the fact that really there's a David and Goliath story that's happening here, and that, that these maritimers held out for, 75 years, that's pretty good. In terms of just against the British Empire, and that could be some source of pride. And also, I think, just in closing, I'm sure there's many other reasons. These are just, reasons that are going on in my head in terms of this story being buried around the resistance, is also just the kind of 21st century or contemporary judgment of the standard warfare of the period in which, civilians were targeted. And I just think that you know, that in some of the public conversation, you know, suggesting that the Mi'kmaq warriors who actually killed civilians were criminals and somehow outside of the, I just think that that doesn't really do justice to trying to understand actually what the motivations were. And the fact that they were using the tools of that time period, you know, makes sense to me that we could, you know, be, you know, just present to the complexity of their experience in terms of, you know, what was happening to them as well, on both cases. So that's, you know, some discussion around why perhaps this story of resistance has you know, been untold until, you know, it's been told in various ways, but in terms of championed, I guess, it has not been.